You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Well, everybody, this is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from Booger County in the mysterious Ozarks in Mid-America, and our special fantastic guest this week, it's Brooks Agnew from ArcOfMillionsOfYears.com. New discoveries and light on the creation. We're going to be talking about the Nephilim. And welcome, Dr. Agnew.
Thank you very much, Bluewater.
Hey, you bet. We loved your show on Coast to Coast and gave it a shot, and appreciate you coming on Prophecy Keepers. So you're, you're in Arlington, Texas right now, right?
Yes, I'm in Arlington, Texas right now.
So what's been going on in your life lately?
Well, we are working on Volume 2 of the Ark of Millions of Years. When we originally submitted our book to the publisher, it was around 750 pages, and basically they said, too big, can't print it. So
yeah.
We took a couple hundred pages out of the book, and it made a good basis for a second volume. Basically, we shut off the timeline at the present, and so the next volume will take us from the present to the future.
Excellent. So I know recently we had another guest that discussed this. This is a really hot topic about the Nephilim, but you've got some other things to talk about. I love your idea that this earth may actually be the ark, and that the biblical story that's been presented to us may, though it may also be true, it may also be allegorical. And so, you know, we don't run this. I when you were on Coast, I'm sure you guys ran on a script. You talked for 3 hours, but we run this show with the seat of our pants, and you know, we're. We want you to go ahead and talk about, lead us wherever you want to go on this interview, Dr. Brooks.
Oh, that's all right. One of the things I'd like to say is that none of my interviews are scripted.
Oh, is that right? I figured Coast, everything's scripted.
No, we were just actually able to speak for 3 hours extemporaneously on the subjects covered by the book, and it was as fascinating for me as it was for them, I guess.
Yeah, it's a fun subject. And well, tell us about... tell us about the concept that the Earth may have come through a black hole, and that the Earth itself may be an arc that came across a cosmic sea, and tell us about the Nephilim.
All right. Well, as a physicist, what I've done for the last 20 years is try to study the spectroscopy of creation. I guess that's what we all do, but physicists are like the ancient prophets. We just look into the heavens with the best skill and the best instruments that we have, and when we do that, we're looking at the past, and it's billions and billions of years of past, because it takes that long for the light from those stars or galaxies to reach us.
Sounds familiar. Billions and billions.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
It is.
What our mathematicians and those of us with great imaginations in the science of physics do is we try to imagine about the way matter is pulling on itself across the universe, and our observations indicate that the forces that are at work in the universe indicate that there's a lot more matter, there's a lot more force than what we have evidence for.
Uh-huh.
And Einstein and Rosen sort of got together and laid the mathematical groundwork for a gravitational body that really not until the 1960s was termed a black hole. And a black hole is a collapsed star or a collapsed gravitational pinpoint, if you will, in space, where the gravity is so intense that light itself cannot escape that area, and so it doesn't give off any light. It's just dark to an outside observer. Unfortunately, we have never directly observed a black hole. We can observe its gravitational effects on those bodies around it. We can see, for instance, gases being stripped off of a star and sucked down into a tornado-like hole in the universe, but we can't actually see the black hole itself. We've built a series of observatories called LIGO or LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories, and we're trying our best to detect these very, very weak rhythmic signals that come off of rotating black holes or coalescing black holes or even birthing black holes, but so far we've not been successful. Theoretically, we think we will eventually find them. The trick is making a measuring device that's sensitive enough to pick those waves up without picking up all the other noise a planet likes to make. And so that's the challenge. But nevertheless, theory builds upon theory, and we have pretty much irrefutably decided that black holes exist. Now, their characteristics are at a great subject of argument in our science. But here is what we have done in the book. We have approached black holes from the standpoint that we believe that they are spinning at their maximum speed. And let me just break that down a little bit. Our star revolves on its axis just like our Earth does. We can see the sunspots going across the surface of it. We know pretty much how long it takes for a sun to revolve on its axis. We know the size of it. We pretty much know the age of it based on the species of hydrogen wavelength that it puts off. As the sun burns out over time, It loses its eruptive force, and gravity takes over, and the sun begins to shrink in size. As it does, much like an ice skater pulling her arms in, it spins faster. It's called conservation of momentum, one of the nice Newtonian laws that we rely upon. As the star collapses to, say, 1/10,000th its original size, that ratio of spin reaches a point where it's spinning quite quickly. We see this when we see coalescing neutron stars. These are two neutron stars, dead stars that are coming together. And they don't come together head-on. They sort of come together like two ice skaters grabbing hands and then spinning around each other.
Right. I was just going to mention that for folks so they could get some idea of what you're talking about.
Right. And when we say coalescing, we mean that they've grabbed hands and they're revolving around each other and they're eventually going to spin into a single point. That coalescing, that spinning, can reach a frequency of about 3,000 cycles a second. That's really, really fast for heavenly bodies. Well, when they do that, they make ripples in space-time. They make gravitational waves that we can pick up with radio telescopes. We've learned over the last 25 years seriously to map these binary neutron stars all over our galaxy and even other galaxies. And they become a quite reliable navigational tool. And we can even see them coalesce. They make a tremendous ripple like throwing a boulder into a pond across space-time when they do collide. We believe that these are precursors, little baby pinpoints that begin black holes. It takes a solar mass of at least 1.4 times our sun to create a black hole. It's pretty solid evidence based on the gravitational pull at the center of the galaxy that there is a large black hole at the center of every galaxy. It may be the gravity engine that actually lights up all the stars in that galaxy. So, assuming pretty solidly that spin does exist, what we realize is that spinning black holes don't stay round like a basketball. They flatten out like a hula hoop. And so on the inside of this, what we call an event horizon, that's the point of no return for light. Light tries to escape, but the gravitational pull is too much. One of the things we know about gravity is that it decreases at the square of the distance away from the body that you are. In other words, the further away you get from Earth, the less likely you are to fall to Earth. Okay, based on that mathematical relationship. So this event horizon is sort of like a membrane. Inside the membrane, you cannot get out. Outside the membrane, you cannot see in, because nothing is radiating out to you from the hole. However, now that, and there's another scientist named Dr. Kerr, K-E-R-R, that agreed with this, that these black holes actually form what's known as an accretion disk, this hula hoop idea. 99% of the matter of that black hole exists in the tube of the hoop, but across the center of the hoop, it's pretty much empty. There's no matter. There's nothing with which to collide. However, the hoop, if held up like a looking glass, would be the same as looking down the eye of a tornado or a wormhole. Now, to give you an idea of the diameter across this hoop, it's not a pinpoint. It could be as much as 400 times the diameter of our solar system. So if you took the orbital diameter of Pluto and you multiplied it by 400 times, this might be the open window that this black hole forms in space-time. So a body, a ship, a planet, whatever, that would pass through the center of this gravitational warp would not suffer the tidal gravity that you see in the movies, where something is pulled apart and yanked into the black hole like sending an entire body through a hole in a barrel. It would pretty much suffer no tidal gravity effects whatsoever, but it would pass across large spaces in the cosmos, either across a universe or from universe to universe or from dimension to dimension. And that Earth probably, or that planet or that traveler or that spaceship, would not age very much relative to itself. It would just age at its normal rate. But relative to everything outside that hoop, everything outside that hoop would age tremendously. So when we say that the Earth is both 7,000 years old and 4.5 billion years old, what we are talking about are the two Earths, one created spiritually, one created physically. Upon one Earth, there is man and woman. Upon the other Earth, there is Adam and Eve, up all the way to Noah. The spiritual Earth went through this black hole window formed, traveled across immense distances of space, and then merged with the physical Earth in the orbit where we are right now. The two races, Noah's race and the race of man and woman that were here on the Earth at the time, came together. Their DNA blended, their lifespans, their resistance to disease, their intelligence, everything blended, and we are the descendants of that merging. We call it the union of the polarity.
Hmm. Very interesting. Hmm. So, isn't that something? So, well, you know, Scripture pretty well points out that everything was created spiritually before it was created materially. So, I mean, that's not anything that's far-fetched. That's at least scripturally, that's provable.
Sure, in the Bible, it's left in there.
Maybe it's in Psalms.
It's cryptic enough that I guess the people that originally tried to cleanse references to descendancy further than this mortality didn't see it. But there are other documents like the Zohar, portions of the Kabbalah, the Sefer Yetzirah, that talk extensively upon this merging of the polarity. On the cover of the book, you'll see, well, people ask us, gee, isn't that the Star of David? And we say, yes, that is the Star of David, but you have to realize where the Star of David came from. Before David, before the star, there was this concept passed down from the original occupants from whom we descended, that there was a merging of this polarity, that there was a physical and a spiritual that came together. This is the symbol of the Star of David.
Yeah, it's the kingdom of God coming down from heaven, two pyramids, one coming down and superimposing itself over the pyramid, you know, representing, you know, what we live in.
Right. And one of the things that's unique about man as an animal, I guess, or as a species upon this planet, is that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that we're the only sentient beings on the planet. That, you know, we're not hunter-gatherers. We have a much further imagination, an appreciation for things greater than ourselves. And we realize, and we try to state this as boldly as we can in the book, that we are actually spiritual beings having a mortal experience.
Sure.
Those of us that realize that can, I believe, and we really try to make this claim as much as we can in the book, we can transcend this hunter-gatherer or predator instinct that we have, and we can become, in mortality, this spiritual being, whereby we care about every living thing, and we care about growing beyond this 100-year mortality that we have.
Well, instead of being hunter, we can become the prey. The one of the symbols of the people of Israel is the deer. So, you know, they pretty much have been preyed upon for quite a while. So there's a little symbol
preyed upon by whom? or by what?
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second, per molecule, and this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim supercharges your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Will Bluewater. I have a message here from 1975 from John Wayne. It comes right out of today's headlines. So you Indian folks who are following the progressive trend in politics, you're following the people that supported slavery. You're following the people that have enslaved you ever since the Civil War. Listen to John Wayne.
You know, it's a funny thing, the Indians now, this AIM group have started something that now they're against me for some reason, but I am the only man in pictures that always gave them their human dignity. I never was in a picture. I never allowed myself at any time to do anything that would take their human dignity away from them, and that to me is the most important thing in a man. I have found that a certain type that calls himself a liberal, I always thought I was a liberal. I came up terribly surprised one time when I found that I was a right-wing conservative extremist. When I have listened to everybody's point of view that I ever met, and then decide how I should feel. I mean, but this so-called new liberal group, Jesus, they never listen to your point of view, and they make a decision as to what you think, and they're articulate enough and in control of enough of the press to force that image out for the average person. For some reason, maybe it's these pictures, they have not been able to do that with me. In spite of what they say, people have not taken sides that I'm it hasn't affected my career in popularity, let's say. In spite of the fact that they've tried to make it do it. There isn't a hell of a lot that we can do to change human behavior. We keep making laws to try and change human behavior. You can't do it. I think you can accept it and feel how you would feel in that position. You're being conned into Keynesianism and socialism now. But it isn't going to stop the selfishness of human behavior. It isn't going to stop the greed. If you take $20 and give $1 to every son of a bitch in a room, and come back a year later, one of the bastards will have most of the money. I mean, it's just human nature, and they're not gonna whip it with a lot of laws. I think when you make people conscious, as communication gets better, and you make people conscious of somebody in trouble, starving or something like that, the average person will help. But of course now they've got so damn many charities and there's so much professionalism, you know, if you have a charity, you hire some professionals to work up the charity, and by the time you get the money, you get $4 for the recipient and $400 for the administrators. So, I mean, I think there are people who try to affect a thinking where they know more than some other son of a bitch and try to put a false impression on what human nature is. Christ's sakes, we have proven that we go back to Hope at the first opportunity. Just throw out a little fish and bam, they're out there ready to grab it. So we are optimists. We have to be optimistic. Christ, what else would there be in life if you lose optimism?
Just well, probably themselves in some measure.
Well,
but,
we introduced the Nephilim in the book.
Mm-hmm.
That not only are we not alone in the universe, but we are not alone on this planet. And have not been, not on either planet, the spirit planet or the temporal planet, since the beginning.
Yeah, that's pretty clear. That's pretty clear. So, the Nephilim, it's really interesting. It's not real clear in the Bible, why they're here with us. It's pretty clear from... especially if you read Torah, which I do, the idea of imps and demons and so forth pretty much an overlay of Hellenist Roman mythology and pagan mythology, but originally Ha-Satan, person that we know as Satan, was a created being that was actually in the employ of Hashem. And this guy had a job, and his job was to test us. So
before that, his job was the light bringer.
Yeah, correct, Lucifer.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about the same person.
Mm-hmm.
And but this guy was supposedly a spirit being. How did these corporeal beings, this is the thing I've always wondered, how do these guys get bodies? Are they people like us that progressed further than we did into space travel and so forth, and then made an unauthorized venture away from their domain?
Well, I think what's pretty clear from the documents we've been able to read, and I'm talking about the Book of Enoch, or also the Sefer Yetzirah, or the Kabbalah, is that the Nephilim, yes, were highly advanced, more aged creations than we were, or we are, and that they crossed the line, and they didn't travel away; they were cast out. And the documents pretty clearly correlate with one with another that they were cast down. And so
the war in heaven wasn't a spiritual or the one third. So these were maybe it probably went on both in spirit and in physical. I guess everybody assumes that this all went on in the spirit world, but it looks like there was a physical component, and because everything's created spiritually before it's created physically. So there the physical component of the Lucifer rebellion, apparently.
Well, and without going, you know, too much into cyclic eternity, there are mentions of more than one eternity. There's mentions of more than one creation.
Sure.
Evidently, these 200 or so angels that were cast down did have physical bodies, did have great aptitude and intelligence, and they did exist here on the earth, and their mission was not to be benefactors to either creation, the spiritual or the temporal, but their mission was to corrupt. And they did their job so effectively, by the time Noah was mature, the earth was ripe for destruction, that there was just no way to salvage the people that were on the planet at that time. The institutions that had been established by the Creator were so corrupted they just could not be recovered. And Noah tried. He tried to find righteous people to go with him on the ark. And those that were schooled by the Nephilim, or the Nephilim themselves, or their offspring, we know them as giants, were so intelligent that when Noah discussed a flood, they pretty much said, you know, gee, we're engineers, we're intergalactic travelers, we know what we're talking about, we're not scared of a flood. We can go to higher ground, we can build boats, we can fly, there's all kinds of things that we can do. What they, I guess, didn't anticipate is that it would be a universal, actually global flood from which there would not be any survival, unless you were either protected by the ark or you were off-planet, which, of course, the Nephilim had the ability to do.
Right.
Could they take 100,000 giants with them? No. I'd say the giants perished in that. But the Nephilim, of course, survived.
Well,
and they returned.
According to my just beginning to read into Hebrew lore, before Adam and Eve made their mistake, Adam was about 60 feet tall.
It makes sense. It's difficult to know. Bones of
lost
Adam
stature later.
The bones of Adam were actually preserved on the ark. There was a fear that the graves would be desecrated by the flood, so the bones of Adam and Eve were actually reposed on the ark. And once the ark settled, they were reburied. And it's fair custom now in Israel that the bones of Adam and Eve are reposed in a cave in Hebron. So if they were 60 feet long, I think that would be quite remarkable. But
well, after this, of course, the Hebrews don't have a concept of the fall as far as original sin. But after they were cast out of the Garden of Eden, then they lost that stature, so they wouldn't be that tall now.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that if they were originally that tall before they were cast out of the Garden of Eden, then so the idea that their Nephilim counterparts being giants isn't so far-fetched.
Right, right. And we don't really know what the stature of the Nephilim are, because we don't have anything except for drawings and pictures and legends about them. But we do know that their DNA was rather universal, that it, unlike ours, could blend with any living thing. And so there were aberrations of offspring from the Nephilim. But one of the things they were enamored with were mortal women. And they were especially enamored with the long hair of beautiful earthly women. And so the tradition of the one pure race, which would be the Hebrew race or the Jew race, who decided that they would not marry or co-mingle with any other race other than their own. And to this day, their DNA is quite different than the general population. But they would also cover the head. So the tradition of covering the hair of a woman that they might not tempt the angels was recorded in the scriptures.
Yeah, that's the reason why Mennonite and Amish women to this day keep their heads covered.
And Catholic women in church.
That's
true.
And other people, Orthodox people, Abrahamic people do also.
Correct.
Fascinating. So don't stop there. Keep going.
All right. Well, the Nephilim's mission was to corrupt the earth. And the earth, after the union of the polarity, the Nephilim returned. Now, 200 Nephilim can't very effectively just run for political office or be heralded as gods and keep carrying on from generation to generation. So their methodology changed, and they began working with only the leaders, or sponsoring leadership, as it were. And we do have lots of ancient drawings of the Nephilim, winged and unwinged, standing behind kings, ostensibly putting words in their ear or giving them tactics or teaching them advanced methods of economics and political leadership, that they might, with only 200, be able to subdue several billion occupants of the earth and lead them down a path of idolatry, or at least away from the Creator, and maybe even convince them to destroy themselves, which it looks like, looking at ancient civilizations such as Atlantis and Mu and maybe others, that they've been successful in bringing advanced mortal civilizations to the brink of war and then convincing them to destroy each other.
Well, I can't remember who it was and when I heard this, it started to make a lot of sense, but I don't know if it was you or some of our other friends, but the concept that they have double row of teeth, when I heard
it's not a concept. We've actually dug up the many, many thousands of graves where they have multiple rows of teeth, six fingers and toes. They range in size from 8 feet to 36 feet. Of course, a 36-footer can't survive very well on this planet. 8-footers have a hard time surviving on this planet. And they don't age the same as normal humans. They age.
Yeah.
You know, we get rheumatoid arthritis and humped over a little slow, but
yeah.
we can live with dignity all the way up to the age 100. Giants would become paralyzed from the waist down, or they would lose the use of their arms. And their great pride and extreme intelligence, their brains were about twice the size of ours, would cause them to go insane, and they would commit suicide.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of record, not just in the Bible, but in other books, where the giants committed suicide rather than face a life of invalidism.
Well, my friend Robert Three Eagles grew up in southern Utah around Kanab.
Oh.
And he's the fellow that's worked with Robert Ghostwolf and led him to a lot of the red-haired mummies that they photographed. But Robert, when he was younger, he was raised by his mother married one of the polygamists in southern Utah, and he and his brother weren't being fed too well. So back before it was illegal, they dug up quite a few on Anasazi sites, and he remembers running across skulls that had double rows of teeth, and he had an experience. And by the way, you can look him up. Google search Robert Three Eagles. He wrote a book called The Search for Knowledge and Unsolved Mysteries. But years ago, it's been about 92. Robert told me of an incident that he had, and as I recall this correctly, he was walking somewhere in the desert, walked up into a little draw, and his attention was grabbed by some kind of an animal that disappeared. So he went to look to find out where the animal had gone, and felt cool air, which is a sure sign of a cave. Found his way into a cave, and the cave was apparently led to a complex of underground rooms. And in the rooms, he said there was something like a control panel up on the wall, and there were two, I think he said they were transparent tubes, and there was two bodies, one male, one female. I think he said one was 12 foot and the other was 8 foot, but that sounds like what he found. And but later on, when I was reading the book, The White Roots of Peace, which is the authorized history of the Six Nations, I found out that the name Daganoweda, or the peacemaker, the man or the being who paddled a stone canoe in from the north and stopped the blood feuds between the Six Nations Iroquois people. The name Daganoweda means double row of teeth. And so all of a sudden it struck me, the United States Constitution may, since it was derived from the Six Nations Iroquois League's Constitution, we may owe the United States Constitution to a Nephilim.
Well, it makes perfect sense. I don't know if it was a Nephilim or a descendant of Nephilim.
Mm-hmm.
The Nephilim are immortal.
Right.
But their first generation and even second generation offspring, many of them did rebel against the leadership of the Nephilim, although they genetically were quite a bit different than the rest of the race. They still had freedom of choice. That's one of the human inheritances that we have. There's strong evidence of this if you look through the tribes of the giants that the Jews named. There was a tribe that worked with David, of David and Goliath days.
Gibberish.
David, yes, the Gibberim. They were not only tall and strong, but very fast and very intelligent, and there were ostensibly about 600 of these that worked with David, which was quite a bit smaller than the armies that faced David or that were chasing David, and yet they feared David and would not face him directly because these Gibberim could hack whole armies to pieces. They could run faster than horses. They could cleave a man in two with a single blow, and they were loyal to David. They had made a choice not to follow the Nephilim.
Interesting. Yeah, here's the, I found a note that wasn't online before about Robert. What he had said was, I guess William Henry said that he'd worked, was working on a theory that the great houses in Chaco Canyon were inhabited by giants who were serviced by the ancient Anasazi, though archaeologists believe that the area was inhabited by the Anasazi alone. And he wrote that he had been lecturing in Florida, California, Toronto, and Arizona. And while in Arizona, he had a chance to compare notes with the renegade theologian Father Charlie Moore, and a most enlightening encounter with a true Anunnaki scholar. Then he spent some time with Robert Three-Eagle, who blew his imagination wide open with his chronicles of the grave sites at 10 to 12 foot a tall Anunnaki in the Four Corners area. So that's William Henry. Yeah, Three Eagles is pretty reclusive. You know, you won't find him doing interviews. He did do the book, and this is a guy who knows where they're buried. You know, so
yeah. Well, we have also discovered grave sites all over the world, not only in Utah but Florida and Montana and Australia and Japan. There have been the bones of these of giants, and all of these traits are common. These six fingers and toes, multiple rows of teeth, and we're not just talking double rows, maybe five or six rows. One of the unique things about the Gibberim is that their language was actually unspeakable by humans. It was more like dolphin. A human just can't make those kinds of sounds because we just don't have the oral cavity and the multiple rows of teeth with which to do so. And of course, our brains for our body size, are larger than most animals, not as big as a whale's, but the giants and the Nephilim, their brains are larger than ours and have a lot more aptitude. That is to say, they've been exposed to higher technology than we have. We, I guess, proudly think that we're the only advanced civilization that's ever lived upon the Earth. One of the things we do decisively in the book is we explain that that just simply isn't true. There have been other civilizations on this Earth that have advanced as far, maybe even farther than we have, and they may have even mastered the ability to travel to other planets.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting
right.
garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Put it
Osmond.
Under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
Well, do you think that their descendants were the race known as the Sea Kings?
That seems to point toward the common origin, what we have here on the Earth. When Atlantis and Mu were above the surface of the ocean, they were quite large and advanced. They also seemed to progress to a point where they could inflict global warfare upon one another. And there's evidence going back about 25,000 years of nuclear warfare occurring. We have excavated sites that actually have whole streets of people laid out holding hands in the framework of running away from something as a family, and their bones are more radioactive today than those victims that were recovered from Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
So, that's amazing. So you're telling me their bones are radioactive?
Yes.
Still are?
Yes. The bones are still more radioactive today than those recovered from Ground Zero from Hiroshima. So there was a thermonuclear war or a weapon that went off in those days, and it laid waste to an entire region of humanity.
Well, you'd be talking about something pretty high up on the atomic chart or the periodic chart, because the half life of it'd have to be a half life of what?
Well, the half life of plutonium is 12,000 years.
Yeah,
1,500 years. So, but that's only half.
Yeah.
So, anything that would have been irradiated by that, the daughters of those species would still be active. I have held sand in my hands from Ground Zero, from the first atomic test, when I did my postdoc work at Oak Ridge, I actually held sand in my hands. I put it in a gamma spectrometer and looked at the species of isotopes that was left in that sand from that very first blast.
My parents lived out behind the country club at Oak Ridge. My dad worked for DOE there. And when were you at Oak Ridge?
94 to 98.
Well, I'll be darned. Yeah, they were there then too. He was in and out of there ever since the mid 70s.
It's a big community.
Oh, it is. It's huge. It's absolutely huge. But go ahead. I didn't mean to get tangential on you.
No, that's all right. Well, the point that I was trying to make is that there have been civilizations upon the earth that have progressed as far as we have, and remarkably enough, as luck would have it, actually it wasn't luck that they developed weapons and they fought each other and destroyed each other. Now, you would think, gosh, how do races like this communicate? Why do they follow this common path? Is it just the nature of humans that we're such predators that we're going to follow this path over and over and over again on our own? We maintain that that's not true. We maintain that even the evil that we see here on our planet now, it almost seems as though they get up in the morning, and I don't want to go all the way back maybe even to medieval times with the Gauls and Marco Polo, although he was a great explorer, Genghis Khan, all of these conquerors. It's almost as if they had a fax machine from evil central, and they were all getting the same direction. They used the same methods of torture, the same methods of repression. We see it in South Africa and certainly in Uganda, and it's just horrible things that we would never conceive of on our own. So where does this common origin of debauchery and heartless murder and seemingly unfulfilled hunger for world domination and repression of everything else, it comes from the Nephilim. That's what they teach us. That's what they teach the leaders. And so you have to wonder, the leaders that we have today, at least by recorded history that we put some stock in, they've got more power than any recorded history we have.
Yep.
They've got the ability to literally destroy every living thing on the surface of the earth with their weapons. What restrains them? This mutually assured destruction that we balanced the earth with and had some measure of peace for a quarter of a century. Who made that balance? Who created that? Why did they race down that pathway and then pull back? And you really want to ask the question, what are they doing now? What are the Nephilim doing now with the leaders of the world to bring this world under their dominion?
Well, if these are the last days, then you've got that prophecy that, as it were in the days of Noah, so it would be in the latter days. So you've got the same kind of setup.
Do we see the institution of marriage and the holiness of a father and a mother and children being bound together for eternity? Do we see that institution assaulted in our society today?
Yeah, you also see abductions going on.
Sure we do. We see the same thing that our ancient brothers saw and wrote down on cave walls and on plates and on parchments. We see the flying craft. We realize that there's some other life form on this planet that travels around in a way that we don't travel, making right-hand turns at 40,000 miles an hour and things like that. We can't do that. We don't have any craft that do that. Where do they live? Why are they here? What are they doing? And I have a good friend. His name is Granville Angel, and he's a psychologist. He lives in North Carolina, wrote a great book called The God-Shaped Hole. And he has interviewed literally thousands upon thousands of these people that have been abducted. And he hears the same story over and over and over again. Teachers and policemen and construction workers and rabbis, and it's unbelievable.
Well, I've been convinced for some time that when you look at Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and we're now in the part of the vision, the ten toes. Now these toes, some of them were iron and the other were miry clay. So I'm convinced that there's an unseen kingdom on this earth that's going along with the kingdom of iron that we have right now. There's something we don't see that's there.
Sure, but still, well, I may be making an assumption here that the population of this race that we're talking about cryptically right now is far less than the population of mortal man upon the planet now. And I'd venture to say that even if a nine-footer stepped out from behind some secret wall and said, I am an intergalactic traveler and I'm here to take me to your leader, it's a pretty safe bet. We would not accept that person as a god or an angel. We're pretty proud people.
Uh-huh.
We would just call a spade at that point. So this minority population upon the earth, no matter how intelligent they are, could never subdue us by force. They would have to do it by skill. They would have to do it by economics. And
yeah.
You were saying that the signs of the times were coming to be. One of the signs that appears in Revelations cryptically is this mark of the beast or sign of the beast. And, you know, we think of it as maybe a brand or a tattoo, but actually it would have a function. And the function would be to assure irrefutably our identity as individuals. Now, how often have you heard in the news, well, let's just say over the last 5 years or 10 years, the concept of identity theft?
Oh,
it's probably one of the hottest things in technology today.
Oh yeah, yeah. They're I mean, it's the 666 Matrix. I can't remember the name of the woman in Alabama years ago that when the UPC code came out, she drew the conclusion. Before they started messing with the code, it was pretty easy to draw the conclusion that it had something to do with 666. Now, oddly enough, 666 actually has more to do with Solomon's seal, probably, than it does with John's revelation, because they're realizing now that there are new, there are other scrolls that come out that have shown that numerology that John was messing around with was actually 616. And everybody's kind of afraid of this 666 thing, but people don't realize that that Solomon had 666 talents of gold and silver. Now, why that number? So, I mean, it's definitely there. It's just...
I'm not so much into the numerology.
Yeah.
But you know, when we started writing this next volume that's coming out in January, it's just The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, and part of what was left out of Volume 1, is we started, I guess, realizing what the strategy is and how it would be implemented. You know, my generation, or even my parents' generation, would never relinquish our freedom of anonymity to a seal or to a barcode or a chip under the skin or anything to irrefutably identify ourselves. But my children would probably accept that.
Oh, sure.
And you would think, well, gee, why would they do that? Well, think about the mechanics of it. When you go into a grocery store and you want the discount, the first thing that you scan when you go up to the electronic scanner is a little barcode that's associated with your name and your address and your age and your race and things like that, so that they know who's buying the orange juice, who's buying the ice cream and
yeah.
the bologna. And it's valuable data. I agree with merchants that produce that want to know who's buying the orange juice, what's the demographic, how do we design our advertising. And this, and they pay the stores for this information, and that's why you get the discount on the groceries. But the profiling software that creates this picture of society in your area where you're using this barcode, that's the important thing. And then take it to the next generation where we have this magnetic strip on a card. We call a debit card or a bank card. And it's very convenient. You can go anywhere. I can go to Arby's and buy a roast beef with my debit card now.
Uh-huh.
I can rent cars, buy airplane tickets, do anything I want to do. I have total access to my money. And, in fact, it's become so convenient, I have to admit, I don't carry cash much anymore.
Oh, me neither.
So, the freedom that cash gives us, that I've now converted my labor, whether I'm an engineer or I mow grass, I've converted my labor into a green piece of paper that I can exchange for anything in the world. That's tremendous freedom. And I can pretty much walk in anywhere. I don't have to ask, do you accept cash? Unless I'm renting a car, they don't accept cash, but everybody else does. And so I can anonymously convert my labor into anything I want without repudiation. But if I use my debit card and I buy something I shouldn't, it can be traced to me.
Oh, sure.
So now you have this dual culture that's come about in our world. It seems as though the people that want to remain anonymous are criminals.
Yeah.
They're shipping in bales of cash to buy things, weapons, drugs, terrorism, you name it. Cash is the currency of evil. And so the sales job that's being done is so skillful and so global. It's like an orchestra. We have the euro that's consolidated all of these ancient currencies. We have the dollar that's very powerful in the world. And it will not be long before these currencies coalesce into one currency. For a couple of reasons. We want to get rid of the exchange rate. We want to balance trade. You name it. And then that currency, as far as cash, it's going to go away. It costs too much to print. It's too easy to counterfeit. And we don't want bales of it coming across our borders or going out of our borders to pay for cocaine and heroin that comes back into our borders. We want to eliminate all that. In short, what we want to do is we want to monitor every single purchase to keep you free, to keep you safe. We don't want drugs in our country. We don't want weapons. We don't want armies formed with cash.
Back in 81, they were talking about the fourth generation computer, and they said that at that time they were in fourth generation computers, but they said a new fifth generation computer, I believe that in 82, I guess it was, had been created. And that this thing floated, and it was about the size of a basketball, floated in a vat of helium, I believe they said, and was able to monitor 500 million transactions per second, and was artificially intelligent, you know, plug itself in for a snack and so forth and so on. So they've got the technology, and they've got the chip, and I guess they're making refinements on the chip now.
Well, yes. Let me just give you a rundown on the advancement in computer technology. When I started in computers, I used them. I didn't work on them. I was at a university in Southern California, and I was doing some genetic study. And we had a computer in our department. It was rather large. It took up, a couple thousand square feet. And it used 2-inch tape. And I remember the factory rep coming in and upgrading our RAM. He came in and he finished the upgrade, which took all day, and he said, "I have now upgraded this computer to 8K of RAM. No computer will ever need any more than 8K of RAM. This is the most advanced computer in the world." Oh, we laugh now, but that was big stuff then. You know, we
was that back in 76? Was that back in 76? That was my Commodore had more RAM than that.
So now this computer that I'm looking at on my desk right now, it has a gig and a half of clock speed. I have a gig of RAM. I know this is the kind of computer that we would launch a probe to the moon with in those days.
Yeah.
So the power
and it'd
the
be the size of
this
room.
Exactly. Yeah, right. I carry it in my black bag as
right.
the airplane. So the technology is there. The point that I'm trying to make is that the source of this knowledge. Occasionally, and I've read some biographies of mathematicians who have learned all the known math. They get to a point where their brains realize that there's something missing. I need to continue this line that I'm drawing or this curve that I'm imagining, and I don't have enough math to do it. And in each case, they reach their spiritual hand out into the maelstrom of knowledge out in the universe, and they pull something down. Pure knowledge is poured into their brain, and we make a leap forward.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It's the little yellow pill that scientists say could eliminate chronic diseases and help you live well into your hundreds.
You might be able to increase the lifespan of a mammal by 50%. And, of course, if that was a human being, then that might be in the order of 130 to 150 years.
That claim might be hard to swallow, but tonight on ABC's Primetime Live, co-anchor John Quinones takes the promising antioxidant therapy called Protandim.
I have become a guinea pig for ABC News and Primetime. It's not a drug. It's a supplement. It's called Protandim, and it's a combination of five exotic plants that have been around for centuries.
Have you discovered the fountain of youth?
I wouldn't put it that way, but we may have discovered something that will tell us a lot more about how we age, what happens biochemically, and maybe how we can slow it down.
Quinones has been taking Protandim for 2 weeks now and tells Extra,
I am sleeping better. I feel a lot better and also energized when I do wake up.
Primetime puts Protandim to the test tonight.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
And it doesn't matter whether it's Einstein or whether it's Maxwell or Newton. The story is the same. Although in some cases they claim to be atheists, they also claim that there is some higher source of knowledge that they reach out to and receive. And if that knowledge is out there for us to collect, then it has always been out there. And that means that somebody out there knows it.
Mm.
They can be good or they can be evil.
You
can use the knowledge for good or for evil. So if you were a world leader and you had as your advisor an intergalactic, ageless traveler who said, this is what we need to do next in order to ensure that your country maintains its dominance over the world or gains dominance over the world. And sort of like puppeteers, they pull a string, they give another tidbit of information, and you make another leap forward. Not too far, just enough to maintain things off balance. Because if we made too much of a leap, then we would rule the world, you know, without measure. And they don't want that. They want this balance, this constant threat of annihilation to be maintained. Because they know odds are eventually some man is going to go insane and push the button.
Yeah.
And then the population of the planet is reduced again. And the mission of the Creator is thwarted again.
Mm.
But I honestly believe, and I think most people that I speak with on your level, they believe this too, that there's a metamorphosis that we're on the threshold of as a race. We are very close. If we made the choice, we have finally discovered that there's enough energy There's enough land, there's enough food, there's enough water for everyone. We don't have to hoard it to ourselves anymore. We are almost at this point where we don't have to have people die of poverty anymore on this planet. Now, that means that we're also going to have to rise above the mentality of a rat, which is, as long as there's plenty of food and some place to live, I'm going to have children. And so we just flood the earth with life, and we end up killing ourselves from overpopulation. We could reach a balance where there's enough life for everyone, and everyone that is alive can have life.
Well, yeah, sure. This was the whole message that Rabbi Yehoshua, the man that has come to be known as Jesus, his message was that you live all things common. Gandhi said that if there were no greed, there would be no need.
But that doesn't mean that everybody has to live off of a bowl of rice.
When you go into this system, you get richer collectively than you ever would have been individually. People don't realize this, that every time and every instant that this has happened, instances have happened in the history of the world, and there have only been a few, that you get rich. Unfortunately, you know, after a couple hundred years, you know, you get so rich that you get people that get ideas of that are non-egalitarian, and they want to start dressing more fancy and doing other things other than the rest of the group.
Sure, we see that cycle from within the group, but we also see victimization from outside the group. There have been groups, Jews, Indians, Mormons, whatever, that work together, that try to share the wealth of the community, and they feed it back into the community. Mm-hmm. And what you realize is, hey, where did that big city come from with paved streets and brick homes and schools and music and... we don't have that. Why do they have that? And then there's this jealousy, and so they just go burn the place to the ground. But you do have to wonder, where does the leadership come from that keeps repressing these pockets of metamorphosis where the human race has realized, hey, we don't have to fight. We can actually get along. We can actually feed one another, help one another, share our skills with one another. Where does the desire to repress that come from? And how do you do it to a globe? And we were talking about technology earlier. This computer I have on my desk and the one with which you're recording this broadcast uses binary logic, ones and zeros. What would happen if we went to trinary logic? Instead of on and off, you now have off, neutral, and on, or minus one, zero, and plus one.
Yeah.
What would happen? Well, now you don't have just, you know, two states, you have three. And if you do a little bit of factorial math, you realize now you have six permutations instead of two. That changes everything.
Yeah, it sure does.
That technology is there. But, like the printing press, we can't just come out and with an inkjet printer and put the printing press out of business. We've got too much invested in printing presses.
Yeah.
But it will happen.
Sure it will.
And it'll start with those that want the better weapons first, and then it'll trickle down to us.
Yeah. Well, you know, they've got rumors I kind of wonder who this Maitreya guy is, because he's...
I've heard the name, seen the pictures.
Supposedly been, you know, witness to materialize and dematerialize in front of a large group of people. I mean, if a guy like this was coming in and out of the White House and, you know, got the ear of the president or whoever, you know, and, you know, there's all kinds of things that be going on that we don't know about.
Well, now you take the knowledge that we've put in the book and you make the jump, which is what we want our readers to do. We want our readers to draw their own conclusions. We're not taking any sides. We're not alarmists. We're not trying to paint a picture of doom or despair. What we're trying to do is empower our readers so that they not only realize that they are a spiritual being having a mortal experience, but that their potential is absolutely unlimited. They are not limited to being a mortal subservient. Mm-hmm. They can transcend, and they can do it in a real way. We have the right, we have the intelligence, and I think more than ever before, we have the opportunity.
Sure. Jesus said, you know, all these things you see me do, and even greater, you know, you can do. And so,
but what did he use as his examples? Were they complex? Were they
unimaginable? Very simple.
Yeah, very simple.
Spit, literally spit and mud. It's what he worked with.
Yeah, wolves and goats and sheep and dust and storms and, you know, simple. And he never traveled more than, 60 miles from his home?
Yeah, that's what they say.
And yet, 20 centuries later, here we are, considering his words once again.
Still trying to figure him out. Yeah. Well, you know, the Dead Sea Scroll 4QMMT, which was finally deciphered by Professor Elisha Qimron, shows that, you know, a lot of people are waking up to the fact that his name wasn't Jesus, that was a construct that was laid over by the Hellenized Romans, but because they, you know, one of their gods was Zeus, but his name was Rabbi Yehoshua, but you know, he just called his movement the Way, but we now have more scientific, logical information about him than we've ever had before. And that logic and information really is going to show that rather than himself being a god or a god-man, he was just a human being like we are, and that brings these miracles even closer to us. Matter of fact, if you believe Torah, Messiah cannot be and could not ever claim to be deity, and could only be a human being.
But could be the son of deity as we are.
Yeah, the prophecies were that he would be called son of God, but he you know, when he was asked directly, you know, he never really said who he was. He said he was the resurrection, and that definitely. But now we have proof because we know in the context of the time. Because the head of the Sanhedrin at the time, before his time, could give the kind of ordination that he was historically given, but during that period of time, it could be given by the head of the Sanhedrin, but only with the approval of Sanhedrin. So he was a real ribby. You know, he couldn't have had the following unless he kept Torah and taught Torah. Without any reservations,
mm-hmm.
But he was a human being. The idea that he was some kind of a god actually was laid over between 135 and 333. But he definitely was able to work miracles. And so when he said all these things you see me do, you can do an even greater. Once the world realizes. He wasn't a god, he was a human being, that we can do these things too. And of course this is heresy to Christians and agreeing with Jews, but now we've got more of a historical record now. Not many people know about it because the Dead Sea Scrolls have been suppressed. But the information's there. We can now find that we can do these things. We just have to put our mind.
Well, you're exactly right in the sense that he performed miracles and never came out and said, look, these things that I do are far beyond your reach.
Mm-hmm. He never did.
And you will never be able to do what I do. Mm-hmm. He never said that.
Mm-hmm.
What he said was, I am exposed to the same temptations that you have been,
mm-hmm.
but I have not fallen to the temptations.
Right.
I have overcome all the temptations.
Right. Well,
therefore, I lived my life, and I'm going to use a more esoteric word. I've lived my life without sinning. I've chosen consciously not to sin every time the choice was put before me. So, the concept that somebody had to open the portal of resurrection, that no one had ever been resurrected before, and that there had to be a first. And in order to be a first, you had to have certain qualifications. And one of those was that you had to be absolutely sinless. Somewhere in your life, you had to be exposed to everything, not cloistered virtue, mind you, but real virtue. You had to be exposed to all of the evil in the world and overcome it.
Uh-huh.
Then you would be worthy to establish the resurrection and make a way for the rest of us.
He was definitely different. If you read Ron Wyatt's archaeological work about discovering the Ark and actually finding a cave that contained the Ark, and found out that there was a cross hole, that there was a black substance dripping from the ceiling down onto the box that the Ark was in, and that 20 feet above that chamber was a cross hole on Skull Hill. You know, so anyway, long story made short, you know, they did the work on the blood and found out that he didn't have, that he was a haploid, in other words, he didn't have any male DNA, he had all female DNA, which is supposedly impossible, but there have been others recently that have had, that didn't have, you know, both kinds of chromosomes. So, you know, he was a little bit different. So, yeah, the whole idea that he may have been born differently. I mean, that's within, scientifically within the realm of possibility because, you know, they've got kids. They've got kids that are being born today. There was a young boy named Cohen that was born in a similar fashion, but not quite as interestingly as Jesus was apparently.
And there was another whose legend is mentioned in the scriptures and also in other books, and his name was Melchizedek.
Yeah, and there were also others in the pagan the pagan traditions also. Well, without mother, without father, and
mm-hmm. Without end of days.
Yeah, right? What Christians have in the King James Bible is actually pretty.
Antiseptic.
Well, yeah, you know, Rabbi Michael Shlomo Baron told me. He says, you know, when you read about, you know, people in the Bible, there might be one or two mentions of the guy, maybe one or two sentences. He says, well, we've got volumes of information about who they were.
Sure.
And you know, actually, they'll tell you, oh, well, you know, Melchizedek, you know, so that was Shem, and. Then they have another explanation for the, you know, without mother, without father, and so forth. And
mm-hmm. Well, there are several ancient legends.
We
can get into the armor there really is no such book as the Bible. The Bible is just Latin for biblio, meaning library.
Oh, absolutely.
So who decided what books would be in it and what books wouldn't be in it? And of course, you can say. Well, I've heard all of the arguments of, well, the books that made it in it are the ones that were supposed to be in it, and yeah, but...
Well, the Old Testament, you know, being the Torah, the Tanakh, I mean, that was something that was, you know, laid by them by the law and the prophets, and
sure.
And what was added later, you know, can be brought into a lot more question because of the nature, the whole nature of the way it was decoded and transposed and translate it and so forth. So, but you're right. There's a lot of things we don't know about.
You know, when we were doing our research independently, of course, I haven't known EJ all of my life. I did my research for 20 years and just, you know, filled banker's boxes with it and said, gee, someday I'll publish. And EJ explored pyramids and caves and ruins down in South America and southern Mexico, and she didn't know what she was going to do with her knowledge either. But in 2003, actually it was late 2002, I was giving a lecture on the speed of light, and she attended, and at the end of that she approached me and said, I've got an idea for a book. And we sort of compared our notes and the pathway of our lives, and I said, you know what, that's really not a bad idea. So we hashed out an outline, and this book emerged. And then, over the next 2 years, the writing of this book was the most incredible spiritual experience I've ever had in my life. I'm telling you, I'm brought to tears when I think about it. I'm humbled to the dust because it almost seemed as though our hands were guided as we put these chapters together. And we realized that we had the makings of the most comprehensive book ever written on the creation of the earth. And then we had no idea this was going to happen. November of 2003, there is this planetary alignment called the Grand Sextile Alignment, which occurred in November of 2003. And it was this alignment of six planets. One of them is Chiron, which is actually a large asteroid. But astrologically, people consider it a planet. So it formed a Star of David above the Earth. And in this event, this particular night, there was a full lunar eclipse. So we did some research, which is not hard to do with the electronic library we have at our fingertips, and we realized that this has not happened since the heralding of the birth of Solomon, and that there are several prophecies associated with this astrological alignment, one of which hit us like a brick, which was, when this sign occurs, there will be the restoration of lost knowledge about the creation that will be published.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osman back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Osman.
Put it
under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osman, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
And it humbled us to the dust because we thought, this couldn't be. There is no way that we, a couple of researchers, have done this. And symbolically, we put that planetary alignment along with the flaming Star of David on the cover of the book so that those familiar with this prophecy would pick the book up and give it a read.
Well, are you aware of the prophecy about Kima, which is the Pleiades, and that the Jewish sages said that someday two of the stars in the Pleiades would be moved to form Star of David. And are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of that.
That's
prophecy.
That'd be.
But
of course, that would shake everybody up.
The stars. I know what it would take to move the stars.
Oh yeah.
The black hole.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I mean that if something like that happened, it definitely it wouldn't be as strange as the astrological configuration you're talking about. This would be something that everybody could see in the sky. It's an ancient writing of Taurus sages. They predicted a change in the constellation of Pleiades
Would that be like unto the sign of the Son of Man?
Well, I don't know. It's just, if they're correct, and Jesus' predictions come to pass, the world will shortly see it, this dramatic sign, two stars in Kemah, and that's also known as the seven candlesticks in the Book of Revelations, that are to be moved from their place to form Kokav David in the early pre-dawn sky. Now, exactly when this would occur is not certain, but we do have some clues if we go by historical events that caused the two stars earlier to be removed from their place. Now, the references can be found in more than a dozen places in the Jerusalem Talmud, 10 places in the Babylonian Talmud, 16 places in Rashi's commentary to the Babylonian Talmud, and 16 places in the Tosefta to the Babylonian Talmud. There's a cryptic reference to the constellation Kemah as the, guess what, sign of the coming of the Son of Man in the New Testament, you know, Gospel of Matthew. Now, especially when you know, you start thinking about after the people of Israel were allowed to go back and reoccupy their own land, you know, there's, and now the temple incense has been found, and then you've got, there's a prophecy that goes along with that. Now, as of a few weeks ago, the copper scroll was discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was the only metal scroll, and it was translated. That led to the discovery of the ashes of the red heifer, one of the 22 remaining juglets of holy anointing oil that was mixed and made by Moses, 21 of which are inside the ark. And there's the temple incense was found. Now all they needed now is the ark itself and the rest of the temple furnishings and the vestments, and they can start. And they're already starting talks about setting up,
restoring the temple.
Well, the tabernacle first.
I see.
It'd be very simple to set up tabernacle. You see, the first thing they're going to undertake is getting the sacrifices going again, because I think they all realize that, even the Orthodox Jews realize that that unless periodically you do at least water sacrifice, then I understand there's something called corpse defilement. So in order for them to be fully living Torah, they've got to start up the sacrifices again. So this is what they're talking about right now. And then, you know, they realized that they could probably rebuild the entire temple, including all its inner courts and outer courts, and still have about 60 feet between the outer wall and the walls from the Dome of the Rock. So a lot of exciting
things going on. Again, the sons of Levi come forward.
Yeah, well, they're forward, and now they've got it's DNA. There's a Cohen haplotype that they've identified. It's very easy, and they found that 90% of people who have been told all their lives are Cohens are actually Cohenim, which is a real testament to the loyalty of their wives. Because, you know, even if you had a little messing around, you know, you have a
right, exactly.
The 90%. Boy, there's some exciting things going on, and then, you know, you've actually got this discovery of Dead Sea Scroll 4QMMT and the scholarship of Clint Van Nest.
Then you've got the Nag Hammadi library, discovered and then scattered throughout the black market, and then some of it was recovered, and then these were actually copper scrolls that were found in goat caves in Nag Hammadi, and they were cut apart. Well, somebody finally figured out how to do it. They cut it apart with a water saw, and then put the pieces of the scrolls back together. But the translations, and I've read even the most modern one, is cut into pieces. It's translated by uninspired men, and so the literal language that was used in those days was translated as directly semantically into English as possible, but the meaning, the flavor, the point that they were trying to make in many cases, was lost.
Well, you can't translate. One of the problems with the New Testament is you can't translate Semitic concepts very well into Greek, much less into Greek and into English.
Yeah.
And, but now they're realizing that the all these 2,000 years we've been told that the Pharisees were the problem. They weren't. Actually, what happened was a group of priests bought the control of the temple. They took over the Sadducee text. The real Sadducees were actually Zadokies. They went into the desert to Qumran and started writing. This teacher of righteousness is the person who wrote 4QMMT that explained what was going on at the time in the light of the times. So people are beginning to reason, hey, you know, the Pharisees had a bad rap. Jesus himself was a Pharisee. He was ordained. He had a right to teach. He had a large following. And everything just kind of got lost in the shuffle because under the law of Moses, there is a way for Gentiles to worship, and they're only required to keep seven commandments rather than 10. But, you know, after the temple was destroyed in 71, things just kind of got out of control and got really, the teachings really got marred, and you got some things laid over. But the exciting thing is the original records of the Nazarene or Nazarene sect have been restored, and you can now study those. And there is so much exciting that's going on right now. It's an explosion. Absolutely.
Oh, it is, and I don't expect the vast population of the world to go out and try to buy these ancient texts and read them and pray about them and do as much research as you and I have done. But you know, when we published the book, we realized it wasn't complete, so we're trying to get volume two done. We thought that we could in literary style, in a way that people can read it and understand it. We even double spaced the book to make it easy for people to understand. That maybe we could publish a work that not only would be timeless, but would help people who, no matter what religion they are, and I've gotten fan mail from all kinds of different people, that they have reached an impasse in their own church and their own religion.
Oh, yeah.
And they were considering, you know, becoming a religious or forming their own church, or they go to church every Sunday, but they're not really there because they realize that there's just so much more than what's being preached every single Sunday. And they read the book and they say, this is the piece. This is what I was looking for. I'm going to go back and I'm going to read the Bible again because I knew this was there. And they're excited about it, which pleases me much more than my publisher telling us that they have 20,305 authors, and we're the number one selling authors. I was pleased to hear that, but I'm more pleased when I receive very personal letters from people that say,
yeah,
you know, thank you for bringing me back from the brink of ignominy. I now understand who I am and what I can become.
Well, thanks to the explosion, you know, books like the ones you publish and the explosion of information we now have going on. You know, what the Bible describes as the restoration of all things spoken of all the mouths of all the holy prophets.
Mm-hmm.
I want to put in a plug for a new friend of mine, Clinton Van Nest, who was a former Baptist preacher that rediscovered the Nazarene sect and the original religion from Dead Sea Scrolls and other sources, and he has reconstructed the Book of Matthew. And I recommend you also, Dr. Agnew, Netzarim, netzarim.co.il. This is the
Netzarim.il?
Israel. Netzarim.co.il, the restored Nazarene Jews of Israel. And these are Orthodox Jews who have put together the original historical Rabbi Yehoshua, who is actually the polar opposite of the post-135 Christian counterfeit to show you. And it wasn't, when I say Christian, I mean the pagan Romans. You know, they brought their idea in of God, man, and so forth and so on. And anyway, it's a fascinating read to go in and see what really happened and how much information they really got that's concrete, it's scientific, it's logical, and it helped people maybe come to the realization that, hey, Jesus may be more human than we even thought, and that if he can do it, we can too.
That's exactly right. That's it's not that we are abasing Jesus in any way. What we are really trying to do is understand the possibility of the exaltation of man.
Exactly. Well, you know, I mean, Jesus said, you know, and any way you look at it, he upheld the Torah. He had to have. There was no other way.
Sure.
He had a very, very narrow set of circumstances to teach. But the thing that he did introduce was the revolutionary thought that, you remember the old saying that the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection.
Right.
You were saying, you know, this was the thing that was raging at the time in Jerusalem, and they had a lot of people running around saying they were the Messiah, but only one person had actually resurrected somebody from the dead, and it's recorded in the book of John that the Sanhedrin got together, which they never did, but they got together over this, and they said, what are we going to do? Jesus has just resurrected this guy from the dead, and everybody's wondering what I'm going to do, and then so Caiaphas stands up and says, hey, you guys don't know anything. If he really is the Messiah, then he needs to die for the people, and then it goes on to say from that point forward they determined they were going to kill him, and you know, that would explain why, you know, they were hailing him with hosannas coming down on the according to the prophecy of Meshua, or Messiah,
Palm Sunday,
and a few days later they're screaming for his blood, but what they were saying was, crucify him, let his blood be upon us.
And upon our generation.
Right, right. And so, I mean, it was just totally missed the point. And he said he only came to the lost sheep of House of Israel, and I mean, those people were the people that left 1,000 years before was born, the northern kingdom, and went off, and they were Hosea. It points out that those dispersed of Israel that never came back, even though they got, I mean, four heralds were sent out to invite them to come back, and they were butchered and sent back in pieces. But
he also said, in his resurrected form, other sheep I have,
sure,
are not of this fold.
Exactly.
Them also must I bring.
But they became all the nations of the earth. God said to those, to the lost sheep, he said, you're not my people, I'm not your God, I'm going to scatter you all over the earth. And, you know, other incidences with the tribe of Benjamin, they know that they became the Norse, you know, the Normans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Phoenician boats, Viking boats are basically identical to Phoenician boats. And there's so much more now that's known now. But, you know, his mission really didn't have anything to do with Jews, because they hadn't screwed up to the point that all the rest of the 10 tribes had screwed up to, which they had the rest of the 10 tribes had screwed up to the point where they became Gentiles. And once they became Gentiles, and he was able to bring them back in, it opened the door for the entire world to come be a part of that family of Israel.
Sure. When Moses left Egypt with the inhabitants that he led away,
including
there was a mixed multitude, with them.
That's who the tribes of Israel descend from. It's that.
Sure.
Well, you know, you got to remember Joseph in Genesis. Basically, the Jews, they got the right to interpret the law. They got the scepter, and Joseph's descendants got everything else. They got all the rest of blessings. But,
well, they also maintained their genetic purity, and they didn't
mess
with the Nephilim or their descendants.
Right.
And so they the blessings that went with keeping that purity also pass along to their present population.
But Joseph's people and the other tribes, they went worldwide.
Sure.
They went worldwide, and
yeah, the tribe of Joseph, which is the root of Jesse, they traveled across the world, and their sons, Manasseh, Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they had two other sons, but I think they had some more sons.
Yeah, Ephraim, Manasseh, and then because of the incident with Joseph's divining cup, Benjamin became part of the house of Joseph, and but. You know, the tribes are starting to come back in, and just as prophesied, they're coming back in the reverse order that they left in. So the first, the smallest first. Well, Manasseh has come back in.
Yes.
They've come back in from India, and now they have tribes in Afghanistan that have never lost their tribal names. They've never lost their festivals and their identity, their tribal identity, and. Rabbi Mikhail was telling me that he attended a funeral with some of these people. Of course, they moved into the most dangerous area of Israel, well, in the West Bank. He says these people are so hardcore. Anyway, he goes to this funeral, and there's women around, you know, and he's saying, where's the men, you know? And
they're not allowed.
They said, look up in the trees. There's 50 guys up in the trees with M16s and sniper rifles doing security for the... he says, they're hard. These are Afghanistan guys. They're hardcore. But they're Israel.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
There is a growing movement of people who are deciding to make their lives better. At LifeVantage, we're in the business of change, of improving quality of life globally and restoring the ability to make dreams a reality. Your quest for personal fulfillment begins here. Our flagship product, Protandem, the Nrf2 Synergizer, is the key to fighting oxidative stress. This daily supplement, comprised of natural ingredients, activates the body's antioxidant enzymes to eliminate free radicals, which cause oxidative stress. Protandem has been tested in the laboratories of renowned universities, such as The Ohio State University, LSU, and the University of Colorado, Denver. These studies found on PubMed.gov, the U.S. government's online scientific library, clinically show that Protandem reduces oxidative stress.
When I saw that Protandem reduces oxidative stress by 40% in 30 days, I was all in for the rest of my life.
Everyone begs us for science as an industry. Where's your proof? Well, we have that also.
LifeVantage is devoted to advancing Nrf2 science and leading the fight against oxidative stress.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
And it's really exciting what's going on, especially with October 13th of last year, the reinstitution of the revival of the Great Sanhedrin, and then the man who dug up those articles that I was telling you about, Wendell Jones, with the help of a friend of mine by the name of Ben Yosef. Ben Yosef found the cave that they discovered the temple incense in, but Wendell Jones found the holy anointing oil and ashes of the red heifer. But he's been given the go-ahead, the blessing of an unnamed Kabbalist, who's, you know, probably some high-level unnamed Rebbe, to go ahead and to look for the Ark of the Covenant, and they're shooting for the middle of August.
Mm. Well, our book comes out in January, and we have a whole chapter on the Ark of the Covenant, and we've got some things to reveal that are going to change everything.
Well. I don't want to keep you forever. Keep talking as long as you want to, but I don't want to keep you too.
Well, that's quite all right. It just appears as we've had another unscripted 3-hour radio interview.
But we've done 3 hours in the last hour and a half. That's what we've done. So.
Yes, but for those people that would like to find the book, you can. Go to the website arcofmillionsofyears.com, and that's ARC like Noah's Ark. I have
right.
people saying, I put in ARC and I can't find it. Or, of course, you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or any of the online booksellers. I think there's about 48 of them that sell the book. Or you can walk into your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth booksellers and pick up the book.
Right, and you can, on our website, of course, from the page that people are listening to, there'll be a link over to your book. Or we also have a concession on the website. From the button near the top of the website, it says store.
Okay. And on our website as well, there's a link to prophecykeepers.com.
Right.
So you can find Blue Otter and his work.
This show will be archived for at least a year, so you can just leave a permanent URL up there, and I'll send that URL to you. Basically, the URL is prophecykeepers.com/agnew1.html, and I'll send that to you. And again, that way you can invite folks to come on over here, and we want to have you back.
I would be overjoyed to come back.
You bet.
I can't believe how well this has gone, and how eloquent you are, and knowledgeable you are, and this book would not have sold 5 copies, me and 4 of my friends, if it was not for shows like yours and the great work that you did. And I want to recognize Mary Sutherland and her work. She's probably the first person that I interviewed with, and she made it easy for us. And,
we'd have never gotten our start if it wasn't for Mary.
Yeah, I've told her many times she's the root of just about everybody that's doing these wonderful, just earth-shaking webcasts and bringing truth and knowledge to the world without having to pay homage to major networks.
Right. Well, you know, you'll probably sell 5 copies from this interview.
I doubt it.
We don't have... You know, we've got to figure out a way, and we're trying to. We're actually losing. We've jumped up 125,000 places from about 224,000 overall to about 99,000 in the rankings of websites. But we've been losing listenership slowly, and it's because we can't afford to. And this is where I'm plugging the show, folks. You know, we're trying to. Develop this show, and that takes advertising, and what I need to figure out a way to do is get the budget, get another probably about $300 a month, start doing some, you know, pay-per-click. That's what it's going to take.
Yeah,
but,
I really don't know why. I don't have an explanation for it because I don't do any promotions other than these interviews, but our website gets between 7,000 and 10,000 hits a day, so I don't know where that ranks.
And having folks like you on sure it definitely does help us, especially if you leave the link up. And
in 2 weeks I'm going to be in England and Scotland on a book signing tour. I'm being interviewed on a couple
Great.
Of radio stations over there. And the book is just selling like wildfire over there.
Oh, that would be great. Well, you know, I figured the best thing I could do is to archive more or less permanent interviews, and that way anybody that comes to your website doesn't have to, you know, I missed him on Coast to Coast. Oh, I can go with Prophecy Keepers and listen to him right now, 24
that's
hours
right.
a day, 7 days a week, 365, and that's what's going to keep us alive. We also ask everybody to pray. We may have a shot to get a one-hour weekly broadcast on Sirius Radio Channel 132, Wisdom Radio. And that's recently been taken over by Steve Case's Revolution. Been rebought. They're going to be rebranded, repackaged. And we may have a shot at this, folks. And this would sure help Prophecy Keepers. And that way, you know, we can get people like you on the phone with listeners. And, you know, Prophecy Keepers could go. This is actually, you know, last August... one of our guests, who is a psychic, said that we'd have problems until about May, and then he said after that something would happen, and he said Prophecy Keepers would ascend very slowly, and it looks like it's going to happen, but we need your prayers to get Prophecy Keepers on Wisdom Radio.
Well, here we are after May, and it's going to happen.
Yep. Well, we sure appreciate it. Well, Dr. Brooks Agnew, we sure appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you very much, Blue Otter. It's been an amazing experience.
Well, we appreciate you, and we're going to try to get this show up and available for folks here by midnight tonight.
Very good.
All righty.
Thank you so much, and please extend my my well wishes for you to your wife as well.
She's getting better.
Make sure that she's doing all right.
Yeah, she had a little, apparently she's had a little problem with her blood pressure, and they adjusted her blood pressure medication, apparently not enough because she got out in the heat. 2 weekends in a row. The second weekend, she almost went blind. This last Sunday, her blood sugar went up about 6:30, and got her to the hospital. And it'll take a while for her to get things under control. We're also getting her on a. She's a type 2 diabetic. We're putting her on a therapy called diabeticine, which is a 99% effective for type 2 diabetics. Diabeticine, something everybody really ought to look into. If you go to diabeticine.com, you can see before and after dark field microscopy of red blood cells before therapy and then 90 days after therapy with diabeticine. 99% effective for type 2 diabetics, about 64% for type 1. Of course, the reason why people get diabetes is they have problems with the shapes of their red blood cells.
Mm.
So strictly a natural product too. There's a link from the top of the page from prophecykeepers.com banner link. Well, hey, thanks for being on the show.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Hey,
for
you
a wonderful 4th of July.
And you have a good weekend and a good night's sleep.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, folks. This is been the July 1st, 2005 version of Prophecy Keepers Radio, over and out.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing, and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files, and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
You want to get an edge on turning back the clock with just a few pills? Who doesn't? Well, it's no longer science fiction, but science possibility, a potential breakthrough. As I found out firsthand, there may be a way to erase years, at least inside my body. Granted, it's down the road, but some scientists are wondering if a new pill I took might offer a very long life.
It may not look like the Fountain of Youth, but inside this nondescript building, I'm about to become part of an exciting experiment, a kind of guinea pig.
Dr. McCord, okay.
I'm here at the University of Colorado in Denver to meet Dr. Joe McCord, a world-renowned scientist.
This is pretty exciting stuff you're finding, huh?
It is. We're very excited about it.
His latest research could very well unravel the mystery of aging itself. And his decades of experiments may have the potential of adding years to people's lives and possibly prevent chronic diseases like cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. It all centers around this small yellow pill, and for me, it begins with a blood test.
It wouldn't be the first time I've given blood for this company.
They want to check my levels of something called T-bars, which is a rough indicator of a person's actual age. T-bars can identify a condition known as oxidative stress, a kind of measure of the wear and tear on our bodies. Oxidative stress, like the rusting of an engine, is not a good thing.
Bad for the body.
Leading to disease.
Leading to disease and leading to malfunction and, importantly, leading to what we call aging. It is a slow progression of increasing oxidative stress. That's the main characteristic biochemically of the aging process.
The problem of aging begins with the very food we eat to give us energy. As our cells burn that food, they also release toxic chemicals. Those chemicals, you may know them as free radicals, react with all the components of our cells, literally bombarding them millions of times per second, damaging all our cells. The result? Oxidative stress. And we all have it. The body fights back with a system of defenses. It makes two antioxidant enzymes, catalase and SOD, whose job is to gobble up the free radicals before they can harm our cells.
So, doctor, how often do I take these?
And so, here I go. With that swallow, I've just become part of a potentially landmark scientific experiment.
Doesn't taste bad.
It's called Protandim, and tests on both mice and humans have already shown that it revs up the manufacture of those good enzymes in our bodies. More enzymes, fewer free radicals to harm us. Whether that will lead to longer life is still unknown. Experiments to see if mice live longer are about to get underway, but it's a tantalizing theory.
Right now, all we know is that this preparation decreases oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is not a disease, just like aging is not in itself a disease, but it's something that accompanies and is attached to many disease processes. So you can see the age-related...
Normally, oxidative stress, measured by those T-bars, increases with age. But in Dr. McCord's tests, taking just one pill of Protandim a day reversed that trend for everyone at every age, even for an 80-year-old.
They all are reduced to the level of oxidative stress that one would expect, frankly, in a newborn or a very young child.
Back to the oxidative stress levels of a child? It sounds too good to be true. Will Protandim work on me?
The scientific evidence is there. The pieces seem to make sense. The question is, does this translate into something that humans can take advantage of?
And so, ancient Eastern healing and modern Western medicine may soon be working together. High oxidative stress is associated with more than aging. It's been linked to hundreds of illnesses.
It's at the very center of many diseases. Liver disease, diabetes, emphysema, asthma. I've studied all of these. Strokes, heart attacks.
Even mental disease.
Yes.
Depression?
Alzheimer's disease, depression.
Dr. James Crapo with the National Jewish Medical Center in Denver is also researching Protandim for the company.
Are you saying that this could be a cure-all?
You're looking at something that will have a small impact, but an important impact.
We make no claims about curing any disease or preventing any disease. We hope that when enough studies are done, perhaps such claims might be able to be made in the future.
Clinical studies to assess Protandim in both diabetes and heart disease should start in 3 to 4 months. But what about my progress? After nearly 2 weeks now, it's time to get my results. Dr. McCord calculates the numbers. The result? My level of oxidative stress has declined dramatically.
45%. That's excellent.
Just look at where I fall on the graph, before and after.
Which, if extrapolated back, is the level you would see in a newborn baby.
Have we turned back the clock? Well, maybe not on the outside, but deep inside, within my cells, yes, indeed.
Would you suggest I keep taking this supplement?
I would. I can't guarantee it's going to extend your life. I can't guarantee it's going to eliminate any diseases or cure any diseases.
But we do know that oxidative stress is part of those disease processes. I don't want to wait until I'm 80 years old and find out that I should have taken it.
For more, go to our website at abcnews.com.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Major universities and government agencies initiated and continue self-funded studies following the ABC Primetime Investigative Report you just viewed. that originally aired in 2005. These studies continue to reveal more scientific evidence about Protandim's unique benefits. They are published in major scientific and medical journals. The next video will bring you up to date.
Developed after 40 years of research and exclusively for LifeVantage, Protandim is a true scientific breakthrough in anti-aging. Protandim has been reported on ABC, NBC, and PBS, featured in the Wall Street Journal, and described in CNN Chief Medical Correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta's book, Chasing Life, The Quest for Immortality. Protandim's creator, Dr. Joe McCord, is a world-renowned scientist and a pioneer in free radical biology. Dr. McCord is the discoverer of the key anti-aging enzyme, superoxide dismutase. His role in the discovery is so significant, the enzyme is measured in McCord units. For Dr. McCord's discovery of superoxide dismutase and his contributions in free radical biology, he was awarded the Elliott Crescent Medal. This medal is awarded to distinguished inventors and scientists, putting Dr. McCord in the same company as Pierre and Marie Curie, Alexander Graham Bell, Orville Wright, and Henry Ford. Dr. Joe McCord has devoted his life's work to the study of free radicals, their role in aging, and the many problems associated with aging. Consumers spend billions every year on antioxidants in the form of food and supplements, hoping to reduce these free radicals. But antioxidants from these sources can only eliminate one free radical for every one antioxidant molecule you consume. Protandim is scientifically proven to slow cellular damage caused by free radicals. Taking one Protandim one time per day for 30 days turns on these anti-aging enzymes in your body. Your own enzymes eliminate free radicals at a rate of 1 million to 1.
I think any other supplements that are designed to be antioxidant supplements probably are no longer needed because Protandim solves that problem in a much more effective way.
Protandim is a breakthrough poised to revolutionize the anti-aging industry. It is an entirely new and scientifically validated way to fight aging, reducing your oxidative stress levels to that of a 20-year-old after just 30 days.
We found, as many other scientists had documented, that there is a progressive increase in T-bars in your blood the older you get. When these same people took Protandim for 30 days, the age-dependent increase in lipid peroxidation was completely eliminated. After Protandim, we could no longer distinguish the 80-year-old from the 20-year-old.
Protandim is protected by three U.S. patents. Universities around the world continue to initiate and fund their own studies of Protandim and to evaluate how this anti-aging breakthrough can prevent and improve many of the hundreds of problems associated with aging.
Many academic scientists at a number of universities have begun studying Protandim because it represents a new tool. It represents a way of reducing oxidative stress that wasn't available before. There simply was not a good way of doing what Protandim does. Protandim interacts with the DNA in your cells and causes the cells to make more of a set of genes called survival genes. The ingredients in Protandim were actually selected because they are largely metabolized by the liver, which does not interfere with most prescription drugs, which are generally metabolized by the kidneys. So the general answer to that is yes, it is safe. The immediate benefits of Protandim are within several days, the biochemical markers of oxidative stress begin to decrease. And while these are immediate improvements, you may not sense that these things are happening, just as you can't sense what your cholesterol level is, if it's high or low. But nonetheless, these benefits start happening within days of taking Protandim. The advantages to taking Protandim in the long term are that it protects your body from the relentless progression of free radical damage as we age. The anti-aging aspect of Protandim is one that accumulates over time. So the longer you take it, the more protection you will sustain. Missing a dose of Protandim is not a big problem. It takes about 2 weeks for the effects to go away. So if you miss it for 2 weeks, you're pretty much back to where you started from.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Good afternoon. These are on, I presume. I'd like to talk to you today, and do I have control of these slides, or is I do? Okay. Let's get through these really quick, because this is just because you have to get CMEs, and I have to tell you that I am on the Speakers Bureau for GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, and also a nutritional consultant for an HIV nutritional company named Biosource Therapeutics, which has nothing to do with what I'm talking about today. What I'd like to talk to you about is something that I find thoroughly fascinating. It is glutathione. It is one of the four endogenous antioxidants, and it is one that I must admit, despite 80,000 published articles in the English literature, through medical school internship, residency, fellowship, and a fairly long time in academic medicine, I knew nothing about. It is a very interesting molecule because it exists in an accelerated or increased energy state. The energy state is, or increased energy state, is caused by the fact that it's got a free sulfhydryl group and therefore can easily donate the hydrogen to a electron and therefore quench a free radical. Now, let me tell you, because I think it's important, and it is a little bit of a divergence, but I learned about glutathione because of something that you probably all have seen in your practice, and that is a low uric acid. Now, when I was in medical school and when I was a professor of oncology, the only thing I knew about uric acid is when you had a kid that you were going to treat for leukemia, you put him on allopurinol to keep the uric acid down. I knew nothing about uric acid being low, except it kept appearing, and it appeared in about 20% of my patients, and that just didn't make sense. So I finally went into PubMed, and after stumbling around for a long time, I found out that uric acid is the last antioxidant your body uses when it's run out of everything else. When it's run out of gas, okay, it uses uric acid. Interesting. So if that's the last, the question then, what was the first? And that is where I got into glutathione. I've been coming to some of these meetings for a while, and glutathione is very important for a number of things, not all of which I'm going to go into today. But in point of fact, it has a great deal to do with not only well-being, okay, but aging well, or if you will, retarding the aging process. So I think it's very applicable. I'd like to, at the risk of repeating things that you already know, go over some of the things that glutathione is important about. Alone in the antioxidant world, okay, every other antioxidant, when it becomes oxidized, becomes itself a free radical. Glutathione doesn't. It actually recycles other antioxidants. In fact, the body considers it so important that up to 6% of the entire ATP expenditure or energy expenditure of the body may be used to synthesize and optimize glutathione levels. That's pretty impressive, 6% of the entire energy output of the body. It is also the only non-enzyme antioxidant that doesn't become a free radical and in fact has a very interesting corollary when it becomes oxidized, because what happens is it complexes to another spent glutathione molecule, and the compound then becomes GSSG, and GSSG has been shown in animal studies at least to promote and induce delta wave sleep. We all know the importance of that in terms of the aging process, so this, even in its used up form, functions as a very useful product. It not only functions as an antioxidant itself, But alone again in the world of antioxidants, it is an absolutely essential component of antioxidant enzymes, namely glutathione peroxidase, and most importantly, the glutathione transferases. And I bring that up because glutathione transferase abnormalities have now been associated with virtually every cancer known to man, and probably with a lot more than that. And therefore, by promoting the production of glutathione transferases through improving glutathione, we may be doing even more than I'm able to talk about right now. In addition, if that were not enough, let's keep going. It's a chelator. In fact, it's 50% as effective as oral chelation in getting rid of mercury. It has an effect on other heavy metals, but they're not as pronounced as mercury, and mercury is pretty ubiquitous in an environment, so it kind of comes as a freebie. And it detoxifies organic pollutants, perhaps the best known one of which is the two-carbon fragment that we know as alcohol. And in fact, without glutathione, you ultimately get a hangover because you stop the process at acetaldehyde, which is phase one detox, and that in itself is a free radical, and obviously many of us may have felt the effects of that if we didn't have enough glutathione. Now, why is it important in aging? Well, these are old data, and I think they're probably not as robust as they should be, but I'll give you what is available now. Glutathione levels decrease with age. The data would suggest it's 1% a year beginning in the 20s. I think that's too little, too late, but that's only my opinion right now. I haven't proved it. There are some very interesting things, though. Age-matched normals, okay, reveal that anybody at, say, 45 who's had his first heart attack or has asthma or whatever other disease you want to use has a lower glutathione level than somebody of that age who's well. So disease causes decrease in glutathione and an accelerated decrease compared to normals. Glutathione happens to be, and this is perhaps the take-home message, it's the major protector of mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is that DNA within the cells that's responsible, if you will, for the electron transport chain that produces every bit of energy in your body. And we know from pathologic data that if you take a biopsy from a 90-year-old and compare it to a biopsy in a 5-year-old, the mitochondrial DNA in the 90-year-old is only 5% normal compared to the 5-year-old. So obviously we destroy our mitochondrial DNA, we destroy our energy, and we age. Maintenance of normal mitochondrial DNA is directly correlated, and it's got an R value above 9.9, with aging. So the higher your glutathione, the less you age. And I think
it's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Let the truth